I'm a teacher by trade, and that means that I move a lot. So we learned that teaching is proximity, and so I'm going to prefer to be like down here walking amongst the tables, but I'll refrain from doing that because I know that you can all behave yourselves, and I'm not going to have to come and stand next to you to make you behave. any other teachers in the room? Yeah, you guys all know exactly what I'm talking about. You come and do this. Please be quiet during this presentation. Okay. That's my dad, so it's totally fair. So my name is Paula Hawks. I am running for U.S. House. I am very pleased to have this opportunity to be here. I am a little bit sad that Bill Walsh isn't here. I was looking forward to the banter back and forth between him and Steve, but I'm also a little bit glad he didn't come because I'm afraid that I wouldn't have anything left to say when he was done. So anybody who knows Bill well knows that that's probably true. I enjoy my relationship with Bill, and I enjoy the growing relationship that I'm going to have now with Steve and with the folks here at this event. Again, thank you so much for letting me come here and speak to you. I'm going to give you just a little bit of a background on myself, where I'm from, what I'm about, and why it is that I'm doing this. I did grow up in Flandreau, outside of Flandreau, on the family farm. My dad's here, my sister's here. I'm well represented with my family. And that really is what it's about for me. It's about family, it's about community, it's about South Dakota. And that's what's in my blood, and that's what's at the base of my passion in everything that I do. Growing up on the family farm, we learned a lot about what it means to be a part of a community, what it means to be part of a working family, and what it means to come together to help each other in times of struggle and to be supportive of each other in times of good. And that is something that we don't celebrate enough, I think, on a day-to-day basis, just being a part of that community, being part of something bigger than ourselves, and that's what it's really about for me. After I graduated off of the farm, I went on to college at SDSU. And I majored in biology while I was at SDSU. I also got my teaching certification there. It was also there that I met my husband, Steve. Steve is a West River ranch boy. He grew up out by Faith on a cattle ranch. And now is a computer programmer. I'm not sure how that happened, but we just roll with the punches. So we now live in Hartford with our three children. I have a 16-year-old sophomore daughter, Ruby. She's in marching band and soccer and all of the courses and all of the clubs and all of, I think I see her 5 minutes a week or so, which I count really lucky for myself. And then I have a 12-year-old son, Tristan. He is in seventh grade, and all of that entails with a middle school boy. He has his own wing of the house that we shut off with an airtight door. and then I have a 5-year-old daughter, Amelia, who just started kindergarten this fall. And that was incredibly difficult for me and really unfairly too easy for her. She just walked in and was like, see you, Mom, while I snuck around the corner and cried my eyes out. And she's adjusting well, and everybody's having a great time in school, so yay for me. I did something right on that aspect, I guess. I taught at West Central for 10 years, and the reason that I taught was because I had an unquenchable desire to get young people to feel as passionately about things as I did, and particularly about science. And I think that when you take a look at how science progresses and the interest level that goes with science throughout kids progressing through school, by the time they get to high school, they're like, science sucks. Please don't make me take this class. And I say, well, you have to take this class because you have to have it to graduate. And I do it with that kind of enthusiasm because if I say, well, you have to take this class, you can't graduate without it, what kind of excitement does that instill in them? And that's kind of how I approach everything in my life, with excitement, with enthusiasm, with a smile on my face, because that's the only way that you get people to feel the passion and excitement that you have for the things that you are advocating for. And so that started with growing up on the farm and being excited about cleaning out the chicken coop. Excited about, pig watch duty at 2 o'clock in the morning. Excited about the periodic table. Excited about representing teachers in times of good and times of not so good. Being able to stand up and represent them in the things that they want and need, which is what I did as a teacher at West Central. And that's when it got me involved in politics in the first place. Because as a representative of teachers, you have to be able to answer not just to the teachers that you represent, but also to the administration and the school board and the community. And being able to explain why those decisions are being made is fairly difficult. And after 6 years of doing that, I got very frustrated with not being able to understand and explain what was going on. And so after some hard thought and some hard conversations with people who know me well and who I respect, and not always do I agree with them, but I respect their opinion, it became apparent that for me to really understand that, I couldn't sit on my couch and complain about it. I had to go and join them. And so I ran for the legislature, and I won in a contentious district where people knew me. They knew who I was, they knew what I was about, and they knew that they could come up and talk to me about the issues that were important to them, and that I would take that under consideration, and that I would make it a part of my decision-making process. And so I've been representing District 9 for the last 4 years. You know, just getting to Pierre as a Democrat is a feat in itself. I know you're all familiar with the demographics of Pierre in South Dakota. We are outnumbered in the legislature more than 4-1. And so in the legislature, where I went to accomplish a lot of things, I had to do so by making relationships, having conversations, and talking to people that I don't always agree with. One of them being in the back of the room. Hi! Senator Teason is an example of what it means to have a bipartisan relationship, to have good conversations where you don't always agree, but you respect each other's opinion enough to listen to each other, to take into account the other person's opinion, and work to find some kind of a compromise that will work for everybody. Because in the end analysis, it's not about me, it's not about Craig, it's about the people we represent in the state of South Dakota. And in the end analysis, that's what this race that I'm in now is about. It's not about me. It's not about our current representative. It's not about Democrats or Republicans. It's about South Dakota. What's best for South Dakota and what we can do to make it better for South Dakota. And so that's why I'm running in this race, is to be a strong voice, to take the gifts that I've been given and the talents that I've developed over the years and put them to good use for other people. That's my passion. A couple of the issues that have driven me and brought me to this place that I feel very passionately about because of my past, because of who I am, because of how I grew up, and because of the influences of my family and my friends and my husband's family, and what I've done throughout the years, is bringing that strong voice to the industries in South Dakota that need it, particularly right now, agriculture. Agriculture is in a hurting position and has been for several years. And that's not just in South Dakota, that's across the agricultural states in this country. And some decisions that have been made have not been advantageous for agriculture. And right now, South Dakota is in a position where we have lost some things that were incredibly important to our position in agriculture. Country of origin labeling, in particular. It's an incredibly important marketing tool for South Dakota producers. And we no longer have that marketing tool at our disposal because of outside influences and because of decision-making processes that didn't always take into account the importance of South Dakota constituencies. And so that decision has led to some losses for us. And with the beef market being what it is right now, we can't afford any of those kind of political losses. And so that's something that we need to work hard to bring back to South Dakota. And that comes through leadership and developing those relationships that are necessary to make that happen. And that's something that I've been working on for years in my life and something that I will continue to work on as I move through this election process. And in the end, if I'm fortunate enough to gain that position, to take that skill to Washington, D.C. and make use of it to do better for South Dakota agriculture. Another issue, another area where we've lost in agriculture and where it also affects our number two industry in South Dakota, which is tourism, is the loss of CRP acres. In the last farm bill, the CRP acres, if you don't know what CRP is, it's the Conservation Reserve Program. It's a set aside for land where folks, farmers can set aside land, allow it to go fallow, not use it for agricultural production, but allows it to sit. It prevents runoff, it prevents erosion, it acts as a filter and cleans water as it moves into our waterways. It's a wonderful program for conservation. It's also a wonderful program for providing habitat for the animals that we so enjoy hunting, pheasants and deer and all of the other animals that are part of that hunting habit we have in South Dakota, in that sport and that industry that we have here. And if you've seen any of the most recent reports, our pheasant numbers in South Dakota are down. And there's a direct link to the loss of habitat, and that loss of habitat is a direct link to the loss of CRP acres. And not only did we not gain in CRP acres this year, where we had 700 applications for over 40,000 acres, we got two of those approved for 100 acres, which is a slap in the face to South Dakota. Not only did we lose there, but next year we are facing 150,000 more acres expiring with no plan to up them. And so we're going to lose and lose and lose and not find any way to gain. And so as we look to the negotiation of the next farm bill, that's something that needs to have serious conversation and needs to have a serious bit of priority put to it. So that's agriculture. Another aspect of my campaign that has been very important to me, not only from a political level, but also from a personal and professional level, is healthcare in South Dakota, and particularly healthcare through IHS. I know this hits home hard in Rapid City, particularly this week, with the closing of the emergency room at Susan. This is just another example of where leadership has failed us in making sure that policies are put in place to protect healthcare for the most vulnerable in our state. IHS obviously is a point of contention and a point of great conversation, but it's a conversation that is absolutely essential for a fairly good majority of the population in South Dakota. It not only affects the Native Americans on reservations who are facing healthcare crises, when we talk about life and limb as the decision-making process for getting healthcare, that is not something that I find acceptable. And I'm quite certain that you in your home would not find that acceptable either. And so it's a point of conversation that we need to pay particular attention to. And obviously there are some reforms that need to take place. I know that we have some issues within IHS itself as an agency, and we need to address those issues. But the elephant in the room is that without the first and most important aspect of that, we cannot hire the appropriate staff, we cannot put the appropriate administration in place, and we cannot buy the materials and the equipment that we need to provide that basic health care, and that means properly funding IHS. If you're not aware, across this nation, our average spending for the average American across the country for healthcare is $8,000 per person. At IHS, that number is $3,000. So the reason that we are getting third world care on our reservations is because we provide a third of the funding to provide them with healthcare. That's a travesty, and it's a moral failing on our part. Not just a political failing, but a moral failing on our part. It's something that I will devote great attention to if and when I am elected. And the third issue that I'll talk about that is also of great importance to me, because it means developing great opportunities in South Dakota, and that's what we really need here. Because as everybody knows, we have great potential in our students and our kids who are extremely high-performing kids. They do great in high school. They do great on their tests. They get placed in great colleges, and then they graduate, and what do? They leave. And that is something that we cannot afford to continue having happen in South Dakota. And we need to find ways to attract them here, get them to stay here, get them to want to stay here, and give them a reason to make their lives here, raise their families here, and make this their home. And we can only do that through providing them with economic opportunities that make that possible for them. And one of the greatest opportunities we have in South Dakota is in energy production. We have this incredible opportunity to be global leaders, not just state leaders, not just regional leaders, but global leaders in energy production. And when I talk about energy production, I'm not talking about cold turkey cutting off one source and jumping over to another. This has to be an all-of-the-above approach. We have to find a way to wean ourselves off of a system that is not going to last into eternity, a way to wean ourselves off of the fossil fuels that we are so dependent upon, and work our way into a more renewable, more sustainable, more permanent solution to our energy needs. And so when I talk about energy production in South Dakota, I'm talking about opening up the avenues that our rural electrics are already doing. They're already expanding their horizons and integrating solar, they're integrating wind energy, they're integrating hydro. And South Dakota has always been a leader in ethanol production. And we have an opportunity to expand upon that, but also to add to it with the solar and the wind opportunities that we have in this state. That not only brings in great energy production opportunities, it also brings in great research and development opportunities to our universities and our secondary schools, including our technical schools, because we're going to need people who can research and develop the proper construction of those arrays and those windmills, the maintenance of those arrays and windmills, but also the people who are going to develop the systems and the possibilities of storage and transmission. That is what the greatest barrier for us is right now, storage and transmission of that energy from where we produce it to where it's needed on the coasts, so that we can be incredible producers of energy who provide that energy outside of our state, because that's what makes us successful in South Dakota. We are producers, and as producers, we have the opportunity to gain so much more by developing those opportunities and making them a reality rather than just a dream. And so those are some of the issues that are top of mind for me. I'm going to stop talking about what's important to me so that I can find out what's important to you, because that's why I came. I want to hear from you, and I want to take your questions and talk to you about what's important to you.
I'll start with the first question, and when you come up to the microphone, please state your name so we'll know who you are, and we can get it out there in public broadcasting land. I'm Stephen Weselick, Paula. I've always heard, I've never run for office. Well, I ran for office once, but I've always heard that in order to run for office successfully, you have to not only compare yourself to your opponent, but also contrast yourself, okay? And you've given us some really good points that you're using on this stump, on the campaign trail. But, you know, in some succinct way, why do you think South Dakotans should choose you over Kristi Noem for this position?
Choosing me over my opponent, for me, is a clear decision. I am here to represent you, to represent South Dakota, and to bring a strong voice to the average South Dakotan, because, frankly, I come from average South Dakotan ranks. I came from a working family farm. I come from a strong, very middle-class upbringing, and I live a very middle-class life now with my husband and my family. And I'm here to represent those folks who make up that South Dakota, that branch of South Dakota, which is, frankly, all of us. And over the last 4 years in the legislature, I have shown my ability to develop the relationships that are necessary to make progress. One stunning example of that is the recent education reform that we got through the legislative process this last year. That was not a two-month initiative. That was a year-long and frankly decades-long, years-long of conversations and negotiations and working with groups outside of the legislature, bringing in the education groups, bringing in teachers, bringing in business people, bringing in folks from both sides of the aisle so that we could all talk together, so that we could all communicate, so that we could collaborate, and so that we could negotiate something that we could all come together on. And that's what we aren't seeing in D.C. right now. We're seeing a lot of obstruction. We're seeing a lot of, here's your side of the line, here's my side of the line, and I'm not stepping over unless you're willing to come to me. And that's not just one side of the aisle, that's both. That's everybody in Washington, D.C. right now. And we need somebody there who's willing to step across that line without the invitation and say, we have to talk. We have to talk about this issue, because even though we don't agree on any of the other issues, we agree on this one. So let's develop a relationship and let's talk about how you and I together can go out and convince others to come to an agreement on this, how we can come to a negotiation, and how we can bring about some kind of progress that's going to be meaningful for everybody. You know, the past experience that I've seen is a lot of standing on the side of her party and saying this is where the line is drawn, and if you don't agree with us, that's too bad. We aren't ready to negotiate with you, and I've seen a lot of that over the last 5 years. I've been a teacher for 10 years, folks. My wait time is incredible. And if I have to, I'll come out and use proximity. Taking that first step. Yeah, and he leaned away.
Bernie Usera.
Hi.
Bernie.
My concern is what you had just brought up now. Are you willing to be able to be strong enough with the Democratic Party to say, look, right now I'm not agreeing with you. Therefore, this is how I'm going to vote. But then, do you get punished for that in some form? Because we know that that's what goes on. The party comes first, whether it's Democrat or Republican. Where are our congressional people for us? And that is very troubling to me. So when they tell you, Paula, you need to go across the street over here and start making phone calls for your next election, how do you respond to that? How do you respond to, nope, on the weekend you need to go home and be with your constituents? Instead, you're not building bridges across the aisle.
That's a great question, and something that is on the minds of every person, whether they realize that they're thinking about it or not. I think that what we're seeing is that incredible partisan divide and all of what you just said. And if you look back on my four-year history, you'll see that I buck my party quite often, and not always to the delight of the leadership. But what I've learned through that and over the years of my life, growing up with a father who really taught me to be independent and a mother who told me I had to be independent because you can't depend on somebody else for the rest of your life, I'm an independent woman. And I feel like I have a strong voice and a strong conviction for what I feel passionately about. And that's not always what my party feels passionately about. And in some cases, it's not what, you know, my closest friends and family feel passionately about. Sometimes it's about what's going to be the best for the people I represent. And that is absolutely a tough decision. And there are consequences around that. And those are consequences that if I feel passionately about something, I'm willing to take on. I have strong, broad shoulders, and I can feel that. As far as the phone calls, you can ask my staff. There are times when I've said, you know, there are more important things for me to be doing right now than being on the phone. And while that is an important aspect of campaigning, and I won't lie to you, it is something that you have to do. If you're going to run for office, you've got to be on the phones. But that's not something that should take precedent over your constituency work. And as far as going home to be with constituents and doing constituency work, that's a big aspect. People talk about the travel all the time. You fly out there on Tuesday, you fly home on Thursday. When do you have time to be with family? When do you have time to do your work? My family will come with me to Washington. That's something that is important to me. It's important to my family. I'm not going to be a part-time mom, and I'm not going to be a part-time representative. I'm going to be full-time in both, which means my family has to be there with me. So that when I do come back to South Dakota, I'm here to do constituency work, not catch up with my family. And so that's an important aspect of who I am and what I believe to be a part of my job.
Yeah. Good afternoon. I'm glad to meet you.
Hello.
I'm glad you're here.
I'm Betty Kiwashtera. I noticed that you talk about a lot of things that are interesting. My name is Elizabeth Cook Lynn. I'm a member of the Crow-Kickasoo tribe, and I'm a longtime professor of Indian studies, and I live here. But I'm actually from Fort Thompson. But anyway, you talk about agriculture, you talk about tourism, and you eventually get to talk about the farm bill, and eventually you talk about health care. I am concerned that the elephant in the room is not just necessarily money, though that is it. It's not necessarily a moral failure either. What I see is a representative in Congress who believes that he and she represent the state only. And I wonder about the election of people who think that it's all right to close the Susan. I want you to know that for a lot of people, It's the only port in the storm. To close it for one day is a crime against humanity. There are other things, too, that interest me. What's going on, of course, up at Cannonball. The destruction of the Missouri River started a long time ago. That's my question. What are you going to do? You have an answer? Sorry.
First, I greet you, Tante Giuseppe. I appreciate your presence here, and thank you for being here with me. I have made the Native American issues in this state a big part of my conversations as I've traveled across the state. The issues most at the heart of their concerns and their passions are not just health care and the crimes of closing down ERs and clinics and forcing people to have babies in bathrooms and forcing people to get in ambulances and drive over bumpy roads for 50 miles to get health care, or having to decide, well, it's not causing life-threatening issues, so I can't go to the doctor because they're not going to give me any treatment anyway. That is absolutely unacceptable, and if that were happening at Rapid City Regional, an emergency would be declared and it would be taken care of now. If this happened in a small community like Brookings or Flandreau or anywhere across the state where it wasn't on reservation land, it would be taken care of now. In terms of what's happening with the Standing Rock issue with the pipeline, as I said, I've made issues of Native American importance an important part of what I talk about. What I have found as I've traveled to the reservations across South Dakota, what the folks on reservation lands most want is to be heard. They want to have respect. And they want to know that that respect is given not just because it is expected, but because it is truly a part of the way you see the relationship with them. And part of that respect and part of that relationship is in hearing the concerns that they have. And their concerns are real, and their concerns are important, especially in terms of this pipeline in coming through North Dakota and South Dakota and on its way down. They have sacred burial sites. They have sacred sites beyond that. They have sites that are important to them culturally. It's not just about the water. It's about the land. It's about their culture and their faith. And those are issues that we need to take seriously. We can't just scoff at those and say, you know, it's all sacred. For them, this is an incredibly impassioned and incredibly important concern for them that we can't just lay to the wayside. And so hearing them and making that conversation a part of the decision-making process is essential. And if we aren't willing to have those conversations, then we are not doing our job as leaders in the state and across the country. And there is a process by which those decisions are being made. And until and unless we are willing to include all of the stakeholders, including the reservation folks and the Native Americans from across the country who have come out to make their voices heard, until we include them in that conversation, we are not doing due diligence in our job of making the decision about this. And so that has to be a part of the decision-making process. And when I get there, that is they're a voice that I will be standing up for, because not only are they my constituents, I've made a lot of friends across the reservations, and it becomes an issue of importance not only to me professionally, but also to me personally. So. Well, I'm glad you came up willingly.
Who needs a microphone? My name is Jim White. I'm a local businessman. And this is not in any way meant to denigrate how important agriculture is to our state, but it seems like in congressional races, we hear a lot about that. I'm in an industry, and I know a lot of young business people, and one of the reasons we lose people out of the state is this is the 21st century, and we have a big lack of technology availability in our state. Broadband access to the reaches of the state are very limited, and it severely limits our ability to bring people into our state that might like to live here and work remotely. Has it come across your, you know, eyesight? Do you have any idea or plan on how you might improve that, and what can be done to help regulations get us to the point where we can become more competitively technology-wise?
Thank you for the question, Jim. I appreciate it. As I said before, absolutely we need to expand upon those opportunities to keep young people in the state. And broadband expansion has been a huge issue of discussion, not only at the congressional level, but also at the legislative level. How can we expand on that? How can we bring technology to all corners of the state? And that process has been in place for several years, actually probably a couple of decades. At one time, South Dakota was the most wired state in the country. And we have that infrastructure in place. We just need to expand upon it. And that comes in the form of working with those entities that make it more possible, whether that's the rural electrics, it's small businesses across the state who are willing to invest in that infrastructure to bring that into smaller communities. In terms of making that broadband availability and allowing for remote working in this state, I'll speak from a little bit of experience. I do live by Sioux Falls, and so I have that opportunity readily available to me. And in my last job as an instructional designer for a banking company in Sioux Falls, I had the opportunity to work remotely, but only because I did have that technology in place. And so, you know, it's a joke, but it's not really a joke when you talk to people from New York and you say you're from South Dakota, and they go, is that a state? And then you say, well, yeah, we, South Dakota, North Dakota. Oh, so you're in the South. No, I live up by Canada, kind of. You just got to give them some idea, and they, oh, do you have electricity up there? And they say it in kind of a joking way, but not really. Right. Like, do you have cell coverage? Yes, we're not completely, you know, we're not still living in the dark ages in South Dakota. But that's the purview. I mean, the view that people have, the viewpoint. And so when we talk about expanding those resources, we have to bring that in as a partnership. And we have to work on that not just within the state of South Dakota, but with surrounding states who already have those infrastructures in place. How can they partner with us? How can we partner with them? And make that more feasible and more economical for the state. And from the federal perspective, we can put into place programs that incentivize that growth. And that's something that we need to work with, but it has to be a partnership. It has to be a partnership between the government and the state, and a willingness on our part to invest in that as well as asking them to. I can always count on Jay, too.
Jay Davis, my question relates to this. Not everybody agrees with your criticism of Kristi Noem's decision to give up her seat on the House Agriculture Committee to go to Ways and Means. We've heard that Ways and Means is one of the most powerful committees in the House of Representatives, that it's chaired by a representative from Texas who grew up here in Rapid City, worked for the Chamber of Commerce before he moved to muggier climate. And that we should be honored that our one representative is on that committee. So my question is this. If, in fact, Representative Noem only wants one more term in Congress and then intends to come home and run for governor, how would you relate that political ambition to the discussion of whether we're better served by having our one representative in Congress serve on agriculture or on the more powerful Ways and Means?
Ways and Means has been described as a very powerful Washington committee, and I think that that's what it is. It's a very powerful Washington committee. And if you want power in Washington, you want to serve on Ways and Means. If you want to bring power to South Dakota, you want to bring good policy to South Dakota, and you want to stand up for what's essential and important for South Dakota, agriculture is where you need to be. And you can describe all of the advantages of Ways and Means, but as was kind of alluded to, it takes years to build up the kind of power and influence on Ways and Means that brings any kind of advantage to that representative's home state. And I have yet to see in the last year and a half how that power has influenced anything for South Dakota other than losing country of origin labeling, losing CRP acres, losing in terms of the farm bill and what it could mean for us to have a place at the table where those decisions are being made. Right now in our dairy industry, we are facing some serious issues with pricing and with availability and marketability. And we don't have a voice saying, wait a minute, we need to stand up for dairy in South Dakota the way the people stood up for cotton, the cotton industry, when they were having issues. And they opened up the farm bill to alleviate some of those problems for cotton. We're not seeing that happen for dairy in South Dakota. And that's what we need. It doesn't end when the farm bill is signed. Because as the farm bill is signed, that's great. You put that policy into place, but then as issues come up, you have to be ready to meet those issues head on. And you can't do that if your priorities are elsewhere. And Ways and Means is a committee that precludes you from service on any other committee. And so if the workload is such that you cannot provide any of your time to anything else, I don't know how you can provide leadership and advice to another committee outside of Ways and Means. South Dakota needs a constant and consistent voice standing up for its number one industry, and that's why it's essential that we have somebody on the Ag Committee.
I wasn't planning on asking a question, but
you didn't have to drag.
Yeah. Well, I just want to tell you I have the utmost respect for anybody that that's willing to engage in public service. It's a tough job. So I have twofold questions since Stephen put me on the spot. One is you've touched on the country of origin labeling. And I think it's for those that are not involved in ag, maybe it's good to tell the background and set the record straight. What would you have done? I mean, in light of the World Trade Organization ruling, and I know that ranchers are struggling right now with the prices the way they are. The other thing is more of a state issue, what your thoughts are on Amendment 5. The doing away with the party.
Sorry. Article 5 is what we were discussing in the legislature. Okay, so Amendment V. Okay, so I'll speak to country of origin labeling first. Country of origin labeling came up several administrations ago as a, like I described before, a marketing tool, an opportunity for farmers and producers in the United States to mark their product very proudly with a stamp that said Made in the USA, so that consumers, when they went into the grocery store, were able to look at the display case and immediately identify that that was made in the USA, that it meets the standards, it meets the production and slaughter standards, as well as the expectations of grade and pricing for the United States producer. As a consumer, that's incredibly important to me. I want to know where the food I'm putting in my children's mouth has come from, because I want to know if it came from a country where hoof and mouth is still rampant, where brucellosis is still rampant, where mad cow disease is still a problem. I want to know before I put that in my children on my children's plate that it's safe. And so country of origin labeling allows for that opportunity. It's also a great marketing tool because we have the highest standards, the highest food quality standards in the world. And we produce the best quality products in the world. And we need to be able to proudly display that. So from my perspective, country of origin labeling is an essential tool. And I would have fought tooth and nail to preserve it, regardless of the World Trade Organization and foreign entities putting up a fight to that. I think that South Dakota and the other producer states in the United States should have a stronger say in what's happening in this country than Canada or Mexico or Brazil or any other foreign country. And we can't stand to be bullied into making decisions based on their marketing desires rather than our own. That's my perspective. And now I lost track of... Oh, Amendment V. So Amendment V for me is... It's still a... I don't know how I'm going to vote on that until I get in there. I look at it from a couple of different perspectives. My first perspective is I'm a proud Democrat. And I have won in a competitive district as a proud Democrat, running as a Democrat. But I also understand that in a state like South Dakota, where we have more than a 4-to-1 ratio of Republicans to Democrats in the state house, which represents a state where not even 50% of the population is registered Republican, and we have a gross misrepresentation across the state. And opportunities to make for more transparency are always a good idea. And I think that the base purpose of Amendment V is to provide for more of that transparency. to make those candidates accountable to everybody within their district so that when you have a primary, you're paying attention to the ideas and the issues and what the person is saying and what they stand for, and to see if that is what you agree with, and find the person who best matches what your belief system draws you to. And so from that perspective, I see Amendment V and its purpose as a good thing. From the standpoint of a strong, proud Democrat, running on the values and beliefs that I hold to, that I think represent the values of South Dakota, it's hard for me to say, yes, I want a nonpartisan primary. Because when you look at that, you're opening up opportunities for a stronger party. And that, it wouldn't matter if we were a red state or a blue state, I'd say the same thing. If you allow an opportunity for the party with the most power and the most money and the most availability to put the issues that they want at the forefront, you're opening yourself up to an opportunity where you have no choices. And that's what I would fear from that perspective. Yeah. Thank you for the question.
I'm Sandy Arsenault, and I am an educator of 33 years in the Custer School District for the past 22 years. During that time, I've also had the opportunity, a very humble and rewarding opportunity, to be the president of the South Dakota Education Association, which afforded me the opportunity to travel to Washington, D.C., and visit with our representatives and our senator about education issues. When I went to D.C. my first year, I was graciously met by Senator Thune, Senator Johnson, and Representative Herseth. So at that time, I really built a relationship. When the election happened and Representative Noem then came into play, I can tell you that I was never invited to speak at her table or to have a conversation with her. I went there every time I met with her education representatives or staff. So you talk a lot about building relationships and maybe even having conversations with people you're not comfortable with. What would be my promise from you to say that if we didn't agree on issues, you would still see me and speak to me? You know, both senators were very gracious to always take the time to visit with me, yet Representative Noem would never sit down and have a conversation about education. I'd like to know where you would stand on that.
Well, if you're speaking in terms of education, it's an easy answer for me. Having come from that profession and still being a part of that profession, that's an easy yes. Of course, I'm going to meet with education officials and people who want to talk about education. But when we talk about issues that I'm not necessarily as passionate about, I will refer back to my experiences in high school as being part of the debate team. And when you are participating in debate, you can't know just your side of the issue. If you do, you are going to go down in flames. And I feel that that's the same in every aspect of my life. And it doesn't matter what the issue is, whether it's political or personal or philosophical or whatever, I need to know and understand the stance of the people on the other side. Otherwise, I can't come to a well-thought-out, well-based decision that's going to give me the best view of that issue. And so that's what I take into account when I talk about every aspect of every issue, whether it's education or it is fossil fuels or it's energy production or it's farming or it is economic development or business or taxes or whatever. Whatever the issue is, I need to understand both sides, and that means meeting with the folks who are experts on both sides of the issue. And if you close yourself away from those opportunities to talk to those folks, you are closing yourself off from an opportunity to become better educated. So my guess, my promise to you, Sandy, is that if you come to my office and I'm available, I'm going to make myself available to you.
Thank you for coming to our community, first of all. And Steve, thanks for inviting her. I had two questions. Elizabeth had touched on the No Dakota Access Pipeline protest happening in North Dakota, just north of our border, the Missouri River. basically plays a geographical border in our own state, East-West River, as far as you know, some socio-political border between the two sides. But in actuality, it seems like this river connects all of us in some way, shape, or form. You know, we've all, you know, when it comes to agriculture, farm bills, you know, we're all connected to that river. This environmental protest is a major issue in our community, in our Native American community, I should say. But these Native American protests, are, especially when it comes to environmental issues, it's getting dangerous. It's a very dangerous environment up there currently. 2 weeks ago, I believe it was a week and a half ago, there was a young child who was bit in the face by a security dog. Not a good situation for the families up there. There's a general reluctance for Native Americans to participate in politics in South Dakota. I've noticed it. I've recognized it. I've felt that way in the past. My own family feels that way at times. A lot of times, Native Americans wish to change policy through resistance movements, placing themselves, their families, and their communities in dangerous situations. I personally don't believe in that system. I would rather see and wish that we would change policy from within by supporting candidates such as yourself, educating our own youth to take part in these elections and these administrations. My question being, as I decipher my scribbling here, how do you get Native Americans to the voting stations? I mean, I know that we put polls in certain areas to for easier access, but in certain situations, you can place a polling station or a polling booth in their front yard, and they're probably still not going to go out and vote, which is a major concern. I mean, I say it jokingly, but it is a major concern of mine. So basically, how is your campaign going to bring Native Americans to the booths and to the polls? Second question, earlier this morning I spoke to the campaign manager of Christy Noem, and I presented the idea and the question of having a Native American-themed debate between yourself and Representative Noem with myself as the moderator. I'm anxious to get back to my office to see the response to that question, but I did propose it and see if you yourself would be game to something like that here in Rapid City. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. I'll answer the first question, or the second question first with a hell yes, of course. I would be willing to do that. you name the time and place, I will be there. As far as how do we get Native American folks on the reservations engaged and ready and willing to participate, part of that goes back to what I've been talking about throughout my campaign, and that's not just on the reservations, but it's about building relationships and building trust, which is severely lacking between reservations and non-reservations. And that's a well-deserved mistrust of them from both sides. And so I've made it a very pointed part of my campaign to get to every one of those reservations, to meet as many people on the reservations, to meet with leadership, to meet with the tribal councils, and talk to them about what I can do as their representative to forward their concerns. And a lot of what we talked about on those reservations were about security issues, about healthcare, and about education opportunities and economic development opportunities, and being able to cross that cultural divide and understand that we're all in this together. It's not an us versus them. It's all of us together. And by helping the least of those in our community, we help everybody in the community. And when we are a state that has two of the poorest counties in the nation within our borders, that is not a point that I like to hear on the news. It's not something I'm proud of. It's something that pushes me and motivates me to be a stronger voice for those folks and to make sure that we make that a statistic that no longer exists. And so having those conversations is at the base. But talking to folks who are leaders within the community is what I found is to be the most important, because when you go onto the reservation as a non-native, as a Washichu, it's with you are greeted with respect always, but not always with trust. And so in talking to leadership, you find out who it is on the reservation that you can develop that relationship with
so that they can be your advocate and so that they can talk on your behalf, and then you can be more welcomed into the community. When you are seen walking and talking and communicating with the leadership and the tribal council, people look at you differently because you have made an attempt to meet them on their ground, and you've made an attempt to integrate yourself into that and talk to them about what's really important. And so those relationships make a huge difference. And so from the beginning of the campaign, I've been visiting those reservations across the state. I've been back to them several times. I've joined in the cultural events, the powwows and the Wachipis that are going on across those reservations to be a part of that. And I've been very welcomed and very humbled to have been included in a lot of those activities. And when they see me there, they see my face, they know that I am there because I want to be a part of that and I want to be a trusted ally for them. The barricades that are there for them in terms of voting are things that we need to attack at a state level, and I think that our Secretary of State now is making efforts to do that. But when we talk about the fact that on a reservation you have a tribal vote and you have the national vote or the state vote, and those polling places can be sometimes 75 miles apart from each other. So on election day, a lot of those folks have to make a decision. Am I going to go vote in the tribal election, or am I going to go vote in the national election because I don't have a car and the people I'm going to ride with are going to this one or that one, and who do I decide to go with? That's not acceptable. There's absolutely no reason that we can't make it easier for folks to vote within their own communities. There's absolutely no reason that we can't set up those polling places to make it more convenient and more of an incentive for folks to go out and have their voices heard. And until we do that, and until we let them know that that's a priority for us, they're just not going to vote because they don't feel like it's important to anybody but themselves. And if it's not important enough to them, they're not going to do it.
I don't think I heard anything so far from you on the issue of our foreign relations and our national defense and the turbulent world that's on fire out there, including terrorism. If you said it, I'm sorry, I had other responsibilities, but I don't think I heard it. So let me ask you this. As a Democrat, do you think that we're doing more than we should and that we're more engaged than we should be in foreign countries in trying to protect our national interests, at least from a conservative's perspective? Do you think that President Obama has made us stronger on the world stage or weaker on the world stage? And how do you deal with the uncertain future of what's coming when it comes to terrorism, when it comes to Russia, when it comes to those big issues that are out there that on the international platform have a direct impact on us and make a lot of people worried?
I think that there's a lot in that. Thank you for the question, Steve. I think there's a lot in that and a lot of nuance to how you answer that question. Obviously, national security is of utmost importance, and without national security, none of the rest of it matters, because if we are at risk all of the time, it makes it difficult to advance any of the other initiatives that we have. And so national defense, of course, is very important. It's also incredibly important, if not essential, for us to maintain those relationships that we have with our allies and our partners across the world. And so that involvement is, of course, incredibly important. Particularly here in South Dakota, when we talk about military spending, we have Ellsworth Air Force Base right here. And that's an incredibly important driver of economy on the western side of the state. And so it becomes of utmost importance in discussion. We have the discussion right now around F-35s and whether they're going to be brought to South Dakota. And we need to continue to press for that presence in South Dakota because it means security for Ellsworth Air Force Base and our military presence here in South Dakota, which is of incredible economic importance here. When we talk about terrorism, I think that the approach that we're taking right now is the one that we need to continue. We need to continue to seek out those cells of terrorism across the world, find them, and eradicate them. Because until we do that, we're going to be continually under pressure, we're going to be continually under fear, and we're going to be continually at war trying to strike them out and get rid of that threat across the world. And that's something that we have to continue to be a part of until we all feel safe. And that includes protecting those not within our borders and being a part of that worldwide protection program. Russia. Is that what you're waiting for? No? Oh, Obama.
Do you support what he's done? Or do you think he's not done enough? Has he made the world safer or less safe?
I think that it's not, it doesn't come down to one person. I think that some of the decisions that he has made have been essential, and I think that some of the decisions that he's made have been influenced by outside forces that were outside of his control. And I think that as we continue to look at how we approach this situation, we're going to see nuances throughout that. I support a lot of the decisions that he's made because it has, in some cases, made us a safer place. And in some cases, I don't think he has gone far enough. And so that's, again, a nuanced question that, you know, he has a lot of advisors, and I'm not one of them. and certainly in South Dakota, I look at it from the perspective of how we protect what we have here in South Dakota and how we become a part of that decision-making process, and that's protecting Ellsworth Air Force Base.
First of all, thank you for coming, and I do represent that remark because I am also a retired science teacher of middle school students. My interest is in, that question is involves gun control, and I feel that very strongly because as a teacher, we have had one of the first instances that I know of an attack in a school back in the 80s at Stevens High School. Student brought in a rifle. Just the other year, down on your eastern side of the state, a principal was shot, and we see gun violence across the nation, here in our hometowns and across the nation. And I would like to know what you would do to support or work on gun control, and what would you do perhaps to develop a plan to curb gun violence in general?
Thank you for the question. Let me start by saying that I am a hunter. I'm a gun owner. I grew up in a family where hunting was a part of who we are and what we do, and I support that culture in that sense. I also think that there is room for improvement. We do have a culture in this country of gun ownership that is important to protect, and I am a strong advocate of the Second Amendment. However, there are some what I think are easy, nonpartisan, common sense solutions to the issues at stake. Number one, background checks should not be something that you fear. If you do fear a background check, there's a reason. and when we talk about no fly, no buy, I think that that is a common sense, easy solution. If you are on a terrorist watch list, I don't want you to have a gun. There's a reason you're on that list. And if you are on that list by mistake, there is a process by which you get removed. Undergo that process, get it taken care of so that it's not a problem for you in the future. That's a process that's in place just like any other kind of regulation that protects the general population. Those are a couple of very common sense issues. Education is of utmost importance. Educating people on the proper use of guns, the proper use of arms, and how those are used and why those are used is of utmost importance. It is a right, but it also is a responsibility. If you are a gun owner, you should take the responsibility of being a good gun owner. My guns are not in a place where my children see them or have access to them. And that's a responsibility that I take on because it's important to me. But I am going to have guns in my home. I'm going to have guns in my family events. And so my kids have been taught. They've gone through the gun safety courses. They know how to take care of a gun. They know how to shoot a gun. And those are responsible educational approaches that I take in my own family that I think we can implement across the board. And frankly, it should be on a voluntary basis because people should want to institute those kinds of protocols in their own homes and in their own communities.